K-Mud Podcast presents.
Pleased to have everybody listening in here on the 16th of December. I've got Sean Cherry from Cooperative Agricultural Network with me to talk about co-ops. But in case you didn't know what you're listening to, this is K-Mud Community Radio's The Cannabis Show with your host, Steve Dodge, and most of the time, Sunshine Sarasota. She's gone to Jamaica, bless her.
Lucky.
I know. And I believe that she's checking farms out down there.
Good time to be down there.
Oh, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She will be back on the 29th, so I'm looking forward to having her. So, Sean, it's a real pleasure to have you here on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back here.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to open up to callers at the bottom of the hour. And anybody out there who likes the idea of co-ops, Sean is here and he can help explain things to you. So let's jump right in. I've heard that the Cooperative Ag Network actually has a couple of new initiatives that you guys are excited about. Can you tell us about them?
Totally. I'd be more than excited to talk about some of the projects that we're just starting on. So I'm not sure if you remember earlier this year, there was the Cannabis Symposium up at Cal Poly. There was a whole day, basically, of the regulators and academics and local farmers, and they had a bunch of panels. And
okay, I'm remembering now.
Yeah, yeah. So they're going to do that again next year in the spring, Cal Poly. And I think they're looking to focus on integrating cannabis and regenerative agriculture, which is always, like, really important. I think it's something that we specialize here in Humboldt. And we've been in talks, early talks as Cooperative Agricultural Networks with Cal Poly to see if we could collaborate on what is essentially a strategic planning kind of thing, but it's more agile, it's strategic doing. So it's a methodology that's it's a book actually that was written and co-authored by Scott Hutchinson, who's right now a professor at Purdue University, and we're actually hoping to have a talk with him tomorrow and talk to him about committing to hosting and facilitating a strategic doing session in collaboration with next year's symposium at Cal Poly. So what that would look like is the day after the symposium, we're hoping to have a half-day convening collaboration, facilitated discussion where we find essentially big easies, objectives that we can like collaborate on and just, you know, find little groups and little committees and to start hashing it out and start getting work done after. Because I don't know if you were there this year.
No, I didn't make it.
It was really a cool, I thought, interesting, energetic event. And I was super pleased for Cal Poly hosting that. And unfortunately, it was like what I felt afterwards was a lot of the energy just kind of dissipate. And we were like, well, what can we do to harness this energy? And this is hopefully what we can do with that is just like take this symposium in collaboration with the strategic doing methodology and really like take some of the, you know, a lot of the challenges that we were hearing at the convention early this year, and we were like, well, what do we do? What can we do? And this is that. How do we do it? How can we fix it? What are the issues in industry we can actually tackle? And then how do we do it? And then let's get it done. You know.
So what issues do you expect the upcoming symposium to address?
God, that's a whole black box that I'm really interested in finding out because it's a whole symposium of, you know, state policy, local regulatory stuff that I think what we really have a specialized thing in, how do we integrate cannabis and the regenerative agriculture and maintain food sovereignty in local and like in our local economy? So what does that look like? You know, how do we have polyculture along with cannabis, along with agriculture? And how do we also maintain economies of scale where we can keep ourselves fed and export things? And all of these things that make our value-added products for our business, yeah, and our co-ops.
So do you think the symposium – well, tell me about the expected audience. It can't be just farmers. Who else might be paying attention to it?
So this last symposium had farmers, they had regulators, they had academics. So it was pretty across the board. It was great to see the perspective from the farmers, obviously, like we're on the ground doing the work, hands in the soil, the regulators and the bureaucratic side of stuff and the policy stuff that they have to deal with at their end, and then the academic synthesis at the very end I thought was incredibly illuminating. And a lot of it was, I felt like, how do we in cannabis find that middle ground between cannabis and agriculture that already exists? Because we're being very heavily policy and regulated in policy, right?
Yes.
And when we look at like mass agriculture specifically, it's kind of bad. It's unregulated. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to pull them towards us and be a little bit more better in BMPs and do better as in agriculture and mass ag. But at the same time, we're highly regulated as cannabis growers, and we need to deregulate or be able to deregulate ourselves a little bit would be great. That would be fantastic, obviously. But at the same time, we want to be the standard bearer for these best management practices that the regenerative agricultural community here has been developing for the last 20, 30 years.
I would certainly like to see that, you know, those practices that you're talking about, they sort of fly in the face of the regulations. Of course, that's often been the case. Farmers with their feet on the ground, like you said, are willing to experiment with and then it seems like the regulators in the state agencies kind of limp along behind trying to play catch up. Could you expand on that a little?
Totally. I think you're hitting the nail on the head there. I think a lot of business moves fast and regulation can kind of move slow in reaction to business.
Right.
You know, definitely. And, you know, as you were saying, in the last 20, 30 years, especially during the height, unfortunately, of some of the worst practices of the cannabis boom, some of the best practices of the cannabis boom was also being developed because we had the extra energy and time from the capital we were making to practice really regenerative practices and to experiment and to do stuff like Korean natural farming and polyculture and biodynamic, all the experiments that you were just talking about. We had the time and energy and capital to spend doing. Now we don't have that much leverage anymore internally in our own business to like experiment with regenerative practices. But we still, as a culture here, have so much knowledge around between all the cannabis farmers and agriculture of all these best management practices that we need to continue developing. Experiment and I'm sorry, gone on a tangent.
No, I can see you're excited. So do you think that these regenerative practices are necessarily more expensive than the common industry practices?
No, not necessarily. Actually, this year, because of issues in the cannabis industry, and we didn't get really paid from last year's crop, we had an issue with distribution and our crop got stolen. Anyways.
Yeah.
And I basically made my own compost, all my own fertilizers this year. Had a great crop. Now, I spent less money in inputs, way less. Like, I didn't buy inputs this year. I just made compost. I just made horse manure compost.
Yeah.
And it was cheaper and effective. I can tell you that firsthand. Yeah.
Yeah, and I certainly hope the listeners are paying attention to this because I've mentioned on the show before that I've been trying myself on my own farm to reach out in that direction. And I've always, for a long time, felt stymied, you know, is like, oh, well, if I try to put in a cover crop, then I can't do a second crop of pot and therefore I can't make money. I can't do a third crop if I wanted to. So
you're right. When it comes to that style and growing methodology, especially I think you're talking about greenhouses when you're doing multiple rotations largely
right.
in a single season, it's much more – there's it's a harder fine line to walk when it comes down to that because you're really trying to pull as much volume out of your soil as you can out of the square feet. And I'm an outdoor grower, thankfully. I have one season and I don't try to do multiple – turn in my soil. So right now I've been putting my farm to rest and just making compost for the last month, which is nice and relaxing.
Nice and relaxing.
It's a nice downtime in this winter when I can just focus on building my soil. But that's because of my methodologies and how I've
Well, I think that the situation especially the legacy methodologies that people have used using fertilizers, right?
Totally.
For many years, I used Osmocote because it fit the bill, you know. But slowly, then with increasing speed, my soil began losing its fertility and its tilth. And I grow veggies, you know, which is a whole nother way to grow in a way, you
totally.
Know.
Polyculture. Great.
And I see there that my soil is increasing in productivity.
Totally.
And I'm growing, you know, big tomatoes and big plants. So, you know, I wonder about that.
I think it's – I mean, what's really hard as a regenerative cultivator myself is the market for it. Like I can produce high quality, I believe, regenerative cannabis for it. But when I give it to the distro or the brands or the retailers – they're not really looking for it, or at least the very, very small percentage of them are. And, you know, even to those, you have to sell it to them pretty – you have to be your own best marketing agent essentially.
So what you're saying is that simply saying I grow regeneratively doesn't really excite the distributors.
No. It's unfortunate, but no.
Unfortunate.
I feel like it still excites the end consumer. The actual person who smokes it is still looking for it. Like there – I get requests more often than not, you know, for cannabis. And I'm like, I wish I could sell to you, you know. I have to go through all this distribution and all these retailers to give you the products that you guys want. And unfortunately, you know, with Gavin Newsom, he vetoed the direct-to-consumer bill back in October, which would have given us that exact access to our consumers that
right.
want our cannabis. And it was definitely a shot in the foot, I felt like, to the legacy cannabis growers that really – I think, been the backbone of the...
And it could have opened a door. The door would have been small, but it would have started opening.
Exactly. It would have just given us a little bit of foot in the door to market ourselves as we should, because we're the best marketers for our own cannabis. You know, I think we, who spends the most time, the cultivators, with the plant, we know the plant the best. We know how we grow it. We know how it's cured. We know how it's processed. We're pretty good at describing how good it is.
Well, there seems to be such a disconnect between the distributors and the consumer and the dispensaries and the consumer.
Totally.
What do you think accounts for that?
That's a good question. I think from my own perspective, I see a lot of turnaround in the industry, especially in the distro and the retailers. I see, you know, people moving from space to space a lot. So it's harder for them to really – build relationships, I feel like, you know, in the long term with either brands or clients and cultivators. That's a hard part. I think it's part of the – because we're in the infancy of our market and it's just that we got to build maturity within it, and the licensing system doesn't help with that. I think it breaks us up into these little distinct sectors of the market.
Sure.
That aren't really broken up. You know, we're all one economy essentially, or one market. And it just, it divides us. And I think, the licensing system divides us pretty unnaturally, you know, from retailer to distro to cultivator. And it kind of sets us on each other, you know, where it makes us compete against each other when we're not really in competition.
it almost seems like this was not done by accident, but done by intent. Keep them criminals under control.
Could be. I think... We had our this exact question, I think, came up into our Can Academy back earlier this spring, and I think Michael Polson kind of answered it best. It's like it doesn't necessarily matter which forces were, you know, if it was intentional or not, we have to still fight the same battle. You know,
right?
It's like either it's the consolidation forces of, you know, capital, or if it's, you know, bureaucrats behind closed doors making deals. Either way, we still kind of have to fight the same fight. You know, and we're all on the same team fighting that same fight for the most part, you know, against the consolidation of the market and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think so. It sounds as if a good part of your effort is to try to direct people toward these more sustainable ways.
Yeah, I've definitely kind of drank the Kool-Aid when it comes to cooperatives.
Yeah, okay. I think that's fine. I think everybody should be drinking that Kool-Aid.
Exactly. You know, I've been a I could say, a student of cooperatives, I think, for the last 4 years since I first was the pilot of the first Cooperative Agricultural Network Pilot Academy, which helped essentially found and teach me how to run a co-op, and that's helped found Salmon Creek Legacy, cooperative out there in Salmon Creek. And yeah, and also my cooperative efforts in general have only gotten more developed because of my work with Cooperative Agricultural Network over the last, 3-4 years now.
Now, I've come to understand that the cooperative effort actually can save the farmer money.
Yeah. So, I mean, from one of my mentors in this cooperative sector is George Seaman in the Organic Dairy Co-op. Organic Valley? I think that's the one. I always get that and Organic Horizons mixed up. Sorry, excuse me. And so he started their co-op to basically stop the consolidation of the dairy producers and help family farms. And usually, and they really started their co-op by creating value-added products out of organic dairy. And that's right there, like, I think, the model we have here in cannabis. You know, we have the best regenerative agriculture cannabis growers in the world, probably bar none. And we have probably the tightest knit group of cannabis cultivators also in the country, I think. You know, we only up until 7 or 8 years ago, though, weren't really allowed to really collaborate formally. We were just, right. We had to, build a material.
Right. I know. Back then there was collaboration, but it was your direct neighbor,
exactly.
Or it was off the tail end of a truck at the end of the road.
You're building potholes or fixing potholes was our.
Right.
And we still do that too.
Yeah, we happened. Still do that too. The saving money part, it's so when I started making the transition to sustainable, because I resisted it, I knew it was good, but I still resisted it. But then I watched my soil failing to such an extent that I was losing production. Mm. And I kind of got desperate, right? And I had been reading about Korean natural farming.
Nice.
And reading about fermentation processes.
Nice.
And this year I went ahead and started engaging in fermentation processes. I, in fact, had one of the guys who's working for me on the show not so long ago, and we talked about this. And what really struck me about it was all I got to do is – it's a little simple to put it this way, but all I got to do is throw stuff in a barrel. Okay.
Totally.
Let it ferment for a little bit. We're not talking a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then strain it and feed it through my drip system or my tapes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people out there might go, oh, well, you're going to clog all those up. And that has been an issue in the past with different methods I've used. But I didn't have any clogs.
Yeah, if you strain it, you're good. I mean, I think what you're specifically talking about is more of an evolution of the Korean natural farming and talking about Jadam methodology.
That's right, Jadam.
Yeah, I love Jadam, Korean natural farming. I think one of the Ganja Tree shows, you have Wendy on here, I think, and she's an amazing teacher, speaker about Korean natural farming. And yeah, I've been using those methodologies probably for about now 5-6 years now. Wendy's been teaching me for years. And my soil just gets healthier and healthier, and I just put less into it. And yeah, those fermentations that, I mean, you can make are pretty simple, really. I mean, just a lot of it is like people are afraid, I think, of like just how easy it seems. And they're like, it can't be that easy. And
it can't be that easy. And you know, when your livelihood is on the line,
you're going to be careful. You want to be careful, and it's necessary. But like the main thing I think people are really scared about are introducing like anaerobic bacteria into your soil. You know, you can pretty much remediate that with, bubblers and oxygenation, stuff like that. You can safely like mitigate if you really want to, even just experiment with that,
But sure.
Those are fermentations. Those methodologies are awesome. I love using, the Jadam plant extract. Is that the one you ferment just green? Like yard waste, essentially.
And yard waste. That was the amazing thing.
Yeah.
In the spring, we literally took meadow grass,
mm-hmm.
and stuck it in a barrel.
Yeah.
Meadow grass. Yeah. That was it. It was like, you know,
and natural processes just break down all the nutrients in the grasses, and then it just becomes bioavailable through fermentation. And it's just, bam. It's just, yeah, introducing that cycle back into your land. It's so cool.
And the thing that really sold me, okay, now I was getting pretty good production with the Osmocote, right? Mm. It just had negative effects I didn't like. I was suspicious that the Jadam method wouldn't provide enough nutrients. I was completely wrong about that. This season, I had huge buds.
Nice.
They were huge. I was like, whoa. And the plants were green. You know, they were healthy. They were bug resistant.
Mm.
Right? At least it seems so.
Yeah.
And I judge it by the bugs I see.
Yeah.
I know I'm kind of talking about my own stuff.
That was a good year. This year, I'm going to say,
like, it was a good year.
I think we had a vintage year when it came to just the season. I didn't have any bugs either. I don't know many people that did, honestly. I didn't hear much about aphids or mites this year. I think it was just one of those climate-wise, we kind of hit that sweet spot when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also totally believe in that, like, JDAM methodology. It builds up the plant's natural resistance to those pathogens, including bugs and pests.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the first kind of rules for growing is when your pot lands on the buying table, it's the pot that leaves the buying table. It may not make any more money, right? Mm-hmm. But it sells.
If it sells. Yeah.
You know, and if it doesn't sell, you made zero.
Exactly. You know.
And that kind of thing has really impressed me, especially when, as you know, the market is so competitive and so difficult. 100%. And the expenses are just as brutal as before. So how can a cooperative and being involved in a cooperative address that, expenses.
The simple part is, like, as a cooperative, we Skillshare. Like, you know, if somebody knows how to make a ferment and you don't, you can easily go talk to your person in the cooperative and be like, hey, can you teach me how to make this ferment? And bam, now you all know how to make a ferment and everybody's spending less money and making better pot.
Bam. Right.
Then there's actually, like, coming together and just making big batches together. I mean, Wendy and I did that with, I think, the soap like 3-4 years ago in the K&F methodology. We made a bunch of wedding agent, yeah, way back for foliar back in 2016 or 18 or something like that. But this is the things that you can always do as a co-op that are even more effective when you can organize more, you know, efficiently. And, like, also you can – when you're making, like – purchasing decisions. You know, you buy soil, you can buy in bulk and then you can distribute it and buy it in cheaper, you know, prices essentially by buying in bulk through the co-op. You know, there's same thing with clones, seeds, packaging materials for your retail products. All these things, when you're able to purchase in bulk, you generally can make a better margin on.
And I believe that that's a serious advantage to the co-op.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
I don't know what the word is, a detriment. Co-ops are limited in the marijuana-focused things they can do. Isn't that true? I mean, you can buy soil, but soil isn't necessarily marijuana-focused.
Totally. So right now there isn't much of a cooperative retail sector. Not yet, unfortunately. But there is. It's starting to be developed. We're actually having national co-op calls every month with myself and our CAN group and Salmon Creek Legacy and 4 other cooperative endeavors that are happening across the country. So there's one in LA, cage-free cannabis. There's one in New York. There's trying to start a cooperative processing distro there. And then there's Break the Cycle, PVD Flowers in Rhode Island. They're starting 6 retail cooperatives. That's actually, they legislated into their policy at Rhode Island. So out of the 36 retail licenses in Rhode Island, six of them have to be cooperatives.
And they're retail.
Retail co-ops. It's pretty amazing that they instituted it into their policy. So that's something I would love to work on here for, you know, in Humboldt, or especially at the state level, is to like advocate policy-wise for more retail, for more cooperatives embedded into the structure of our policy, because I think they're underutilized and very useful. Yeah.
So what about things like trimmers or trimming? Is that something that can be worked through a cooperative?
Totally. Cooperative labor pools. That's another whole
cooperative labor pool.
So that's something that can be managed, and you can – so like one thing I'm sure we've all had to deal with is, you know, that turnaround I was mentioning earlier, when you have like really good processors and processing teams. You want to keep them. You know, you really want to like – what happens is like, you know, you'll have your farm and maybe you'll have like your friend, but then they'll go and they're not going to be back.
That's right.
What you want to do is you want to have them around for a couple of months. And then if you do that with your co-op, you can actually organize. So you say like, oh, you guys have them this week, and then they'll be there – next door for the next week, and then you have your processing team, you're like your A team there for 2 months, and you're always getting the best processing done because you have the best processors, because you have that labor pool that you've managed collectively.
And have you actually done that?
We're doing that pretty much right now. We were just talking about that in our last co-op meeting.
And how does that work in terms of what you pay the people?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of – people negotiate, and you know, we – who's asking what and who's, you know, what's fair out there, and you get to actually get a sense of what's fair. You know, I think right now people are talking somewhere between 70 and 100.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, also depending on, you know, if it's bucked down and the quality of the product itself, but that's there's tons of variables there. But yeah, you can negotiate, you know, with the labor pools, so you can actually like keep them around. I think that's the biggest part, is like keeping these employees around, because once they're gone,
they're gone.
And they're so, yeah. You want to keep the best around, you know, like any employee, you don't want the turnover. It takes more time to train an employee generally, you know, money wise than you want to spend. It takes, you'd rather not have to as an employer.
I totally agree on that, Sean. We have two callers. Let's get the first one in. Hi, you're in the studio.
Hey, a great show, Steve and Sean. You know, I thought this was about coop, you know, chickens and stuff. That was a triple JJ joke, JJJ joke. But anyways, you know, about co-ops, it reminded me of Joel Salatin with Polyface Farms in West Virginia, the guy that grows grass and then all the animals just, you know, he has a rotating crop. He's got chicken tractors, rabbit tractors. He's got cows that don't need to be chased. They follow him into each pasture. They're in there for one day. But I was thinking about the cannabis industry and all of the refuse that we throw away. I mean, I've got a shirt from 92, 93 from the Hemp Connection that is unbelievably exactly the way it was that long ago. It's a tie-dye. It's absolutely beautiful. But that was made from the marijuana stems. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff that's available as far as cooperating with each grower to save that stuff, like recycling aluminum, plastic, and tin, and paper, cardboard. You just have another container. It's the same amount of effort. Put it into another container. And we've got this huge amount of I'm by a freeway. I'm sorry. I'm at 36 and 101 here. I apologize.
No, that's all right.
And they, I mean, we could actually co-op all that stuff we're growing. The excess thing we think is no good. Some people, but we've got the option. I mean, you can manufacture stuff out of the piss of the little puffy white stuff on the inside. You can make packaging out of that stuff. It's there's a lot of stuff that we're missing as far as cooperating with the excess that we have in this just one industry. And
totally.
I mean, our genetics are going to come out. We're going to end up being okay. because we have the genetics. I don't know what people, are they settling for swag? I don't know. Because we've got this sun-grown stuff that is phenomenal.
I agree. Yeah.
I always thought we couldn't grow enough. Hey, Santa Barbara can't grow. These mega farms can't grow enough. They're growing McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want filet mignon sometimes. We want a nice prima zona pasta with no meat in it, you know, or whatever.
Exactly.
But I just think that to cooperate means to get out of your comfort zone. Joel Salatin, Polyface Farms, man, did that guy, we're talking a right-wing dude. This guy has got him. He's got it down, though. He is, I shouldn't say he's a right-wing guy. He is probably conservative. I think he is. But just because West Virginia doesn't mean that. This dude has got it. He lays down with his cows and watches their tongue go through the grass and the weeds, and that cow will pick out the stuff it likes. It's like, you know, it's a smorgasbord. We're walking on smorgasbord for cows. But we also have the ability to be that transformational up here, I think.
Agreed.
And I wish Sunshine was there. No offense, Steve.
No, that's no offense taken.
Okay, hey, I'll let you go, man, before a big rig comes by and blows me off my perch.
I appreciate your call.
Okay. All right,
peace.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. And you know, he made a lot of really dead-on points.
Totally.
And it's true that Sunshine is very passionate about this very thing.
It's ridiculous how much waste is involved with the cannabis industry, unfortunately, especially within like the metric and the tagging and all that particularly. I think we're all too aware, especially in the cultivator sector, of like how much plastic is wasted. And I think right now there is also policy being directed towards the removal of the monofilament netting. But that's a whole nother issue. I think that's, you know, I think people can use that regularly and safely, but there's a lot of people that don't too. So that netting is, unfortunately, can be used wrong. Yeah.
Well, just to focus on that, I've used the netting.
Mm-hmm.
I can use it for 3 or 4 years.
Totally.
If I use that stupid jute, it gets covered in mold and it infects my plants.
Right.
I've used twine, you know, the white.
Yeah.
Twine.
Like nylon.
2 years.
Yeah.
You know,
it still degrades.
After that, yeah. I got to go.
I know personally, like my co-op members, that especially if they're doing greenhouses, the monofilament netting is like the most advantageous because you can remove it and just safely store it away in plastic bags for the season and bring it back the next year.
Yes, you can.
You know, and it's safe. You know, you won't have just don't make yourself a mess.
Just don't make a mess. Take care of your garbage.
Just like anywhere.
We have another caller. Okay, let's get the caller in. Hi, you're in the studio. Hello.
Hi, this is Jen North, and I'm calling from Southern Oregon Coast.
Okay.
And I have a question, which I can take the answer off the air.
Okay.
Okay. One of the shows, I love your show. One of the shows I listened to, you all were talking about the tea thing with what I call horsetails.
Mm.
They have like 2-inch things, and you can pull them apart and suck the juice out of them.
Equestria. Right?
Isn't that what you were talking about for one of the fermentation products?
Absolutely.
Sunshine? Okay.
It's high in silica.
Well, when we were kids, we used to love pulling that apart and sucking the juice out.
Hmm.
It was super fun. So, and then it is, I have twin younger brothers, and watching him fall, when he was like 6, fall into a huge patch of stinging nettle.
Ooh.
Was the funniest thing. We were in complete stitches. Anyway, so I can get a handle on both those, but my question is, why can't you just, you have your vessel, the dirt, I mean, I can put it in a barrel, okay, but why can't you just have your vessel, the dirt, and go bury it green?
I think that's just green manure, essentially.
Dirt.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Absolutely. You know, it has its own issues. You know, the most obvious is you have to allow a little time for it to decay in the soil.
But right. Like if I did it now, though, no problem.
That's what I would think.
Mm-hmm.
And cover crops basically do that. You know, I'll grow fava beans Usually I take the tops off and stick them in a special compost pile, but the bottoms are nitrogen-fixed roots, mm-hmm. right? And then the stubs. Yeah. And I just take my tiller.
I've never done a cover crop. I should. Yeah. I should just try it, you know?
Yeah, well, I often feel guilty, too, because I don't get my cover crop in.
Okay, well,
I
mean, okay, in lieu and being lazy, and it's really, I really have inclement light this time of year, and it is a postage stamp-sized garden. In lieu of fava beans, what about just nice, like right now, a nice thick layer of fresh alfalfa?
Yeah, that's a nitrogen fixer,
yes.
too.
Yeah, excellent. There's actually.
And then dig it in you know, March or something.
That would be great.
That would be great. And you're very right on this. There's favas aren't the only cover crop. You know, alfalfa is right there.
All legumes, I believe.
Well, I'm talking about already like a bale of it.
There you go. I think you could just probably mulch with it. It'll seed into the ground, and then you'll have nitrogen-fixed soil.
Right, and it is full of seed, too, by the way. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's mulch.
Oh, yay! Yeah. Yay, team! Yeah. Okay, thanks, guys. Yeah.
Sure. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the show. Happy holidays.
Well, happy holiday
to
you.
Thank you so much.
And I have to say, I'm so excited that I have a caller from Southern Oregon.
Getting reach.
Good reach. That rocks.
I love it.
And you get out there and compost, my dear, because mm-hmm. you're going to see I've taken meadow soil, just regular meadow soil, mm-hmm. heavy clay and sand, and patiently put cover crop on it, one or two a year. Within 3 years – I have a dynamite garden.
Got loam.
Yeah, I got loam, you know, and it's well worth pursuing.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, one of my first, I don't know, like 6 or 7 years ago when I was first like growing on the property, my parents' property, I was like, I'm going to do a little experiment. And I mixed clay and sand and compost and I just put it together and mixed it and I grew a plant. And I was like, That's it. You just mix it together. That's it. Okay. You know, that's the first soil science biology test I gave myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that whole thing is much easier than you think. You know, the fermentation process is so easy.
Totally.
You know, I used to be a big reader of organic gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And they always had a way to make compost. You had to layer it. You had to
– Lasagna method.
There's all these mm-hmm. things. And it's not bad.
Yeah.
Okay. But honestly, I could never seem to get it right. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, and partly in frustration, I just started making a pile.
Yeah.
You know, what do I do with it? I'll throw it on the pile. And then I would turn the pile.
Yeah. You start seeing steam and it starts cooking.
Right. And I ended up not following those elaborate directions and ending up with really cool compost. So I think our listeners shouldn't get hung up on, I have to do it the way.
By the book.
By the book.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Exactly.
And you'll be pleased with the result.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when it comes to composting, I would say put some, you know, put some green and some brown together and wait.
Put some green and some brown together and wait. And that's the ticket.
Yeah.
We have another caller. Let's get him in. Hi, you're in the
Hello?
Studio. Hi.
How you doing?
Doing good. Hope you are too.
Anyway, so my name is Grayson. Anyway, so this year I tried some of the fermentation.
Good
thing,
good.
Right?
Yeah.
But what I did was I started plants really early, and they were way too big. I mean, even when they were done, they were like 3-4 pounds. Right? Cut them down, cut them back, clipped them, chopped them, mulch, and then I fermented that.
Okay, that sounds good.
And put it on them, and they all doubled in size relatively rapidly. And as far as like fermenting stuff, my grandfather used to ferment. He had a big barrel in his garden, and he would put all the trimmings from everything he got, all the weeds, everything in that barrel. And then he put in like 2 drops of Super Thrive. That was his friend owned Super Thrive.
Yeah, right. I use Super Thrive.
He put in 2 drops of Super Thrive, and that supposedly kicked it off. And that's all he used for fertilizer in his garden was that, the liquid off the bottom of the barrel. He had a little tap on the bottom, and he let it out.
I love it.
I bet that rocked.
Kind of reminds me of like the old...
Personally, when you have a, if you have a lawn or grass clippings, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you take and you mix green, fresh-cut grass clippings with whatever soil you've got, like 50-50, mm-hmm. and then cover it with a thin layer of pure soil, nothing will grow faster than anything. I mean, anything you put in there will grow faster than it ever grew before because the grass clippings drop their fermented liquid in a little channel, and they make a hollow spot, like a little ravine,
right.
all throughout the soil, like you whipped it with an egg beater.
Mm-hmm.
So when the roots go down in there, those little channels are full of the mulch, and it digs them down in. So you do that, and then you put a big bucket of just rotting everything from your garden and your kitchen about 2 foot down under that, and that on top, and you will have the biggest plants you ever saw.
Kind of reminds me of like Hugo culture technique a little bit, but just with
Hugo,
the grass clippings.
Very much. And
the grass clippings, man. You like carrots? You'll grow carrots 10 times faster than you ever grew them before if you do that. Because
totally.
The soil, there's no pressure. The soil has been fluffed up by the grass clippings rotting.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're mentioning this because, again, it's real simple. Usually, folks actually have grass or something grass-like right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Or if you have a mulching machine, you can mulch anything green and get this almost the same effect. But the grass clippings, they wilt and rot so quickly, see, and they're the right shape is the thing. It's like mini straw.
Mm-hmm. Mini straw.
Straw on a micro level.
Right.
It's pretty much kind of what I do. I mean, this year, I basically just cut down all my – I tried to cover crop last year, and for the last 3 years, my natural grasses just overtake my cover crop. And I ended up having 6 feet tall, natural native grasses in my beds that I just cut up and weedy and then just, rake into my soil. So that's –
What else we used to do?
No. What?
You didn't used to be able to buy seaweed emulsion.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy fish emulsion, but not seaweed emulsion, way back when I was very small, right?
Yeah.
So what we did was we would go down during the storm periods during the year and after the big storms and the kelp washes up on the beach.
Harvest that.
And the roots of the kelp are laying there like little friggin' brains all over the beach. And you pick them up, put them in a sack and take them home, wash them off. And then you let them sit out in the sun and dry them, put them back in your burlap bag and stomp them to like pellets and put that in the ground.
Love that.
And that's like if you have a citrus tree that's sour and won't put fruit on or something like
right.
that, put a layer of that on there with a bag of manure on top of it.
Got
Boy.
Your bloom
oh,
enhanced,
man.
Bam.
That sounds golden. That sounds golden.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, I had a lot of gardening experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever
done
AF?
You guys blew the law. Why was it made legal? You guys are insane.
Right.
Should have been decriminalized like we did in the 70s. Almost got it passed.
Yeah.
I wonder, have you ever done any ferment straight with kelp? I should try that. I feel like
I've never fermented straight kelp, but, that's what you buy.
Yeah.
Fermented kelp. Because they can't stop it from fermenting.
Exactly.
There's just no
right.
way.
Right.
That'd be a fun little experiment.
Oh, man. It was a trailer truck, a big tanker full of fish emulsion coming up from Fort Bragg. There's a road up to 101 Fort Bragg right mm-hmm. there, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, about halfway up, the friggin' tanker truck blew over. Fell over, dumped its whole load down the side of the hill. Biggest blackberries you ever saw for years after that.
Of course.
Anyway, have a wonderful evening, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thank you for
and
calling.
And thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peace
yeah.
out.
Peace. Yeah. We lost her other call. Maybe they'll call back.
I hope they do.
And it's very encouraging to hear that his grandpa was using the methods we're talking about.
Yeah.
And in the end, there's real motivation in terms of your soil is losing its productivity and you don't have any money
totally
to buy fancy stuff. And here we have stuff that isn't fancy,
yeah. You
know, and it's hard not to talk about this. We've kind of veered a little bit off of co-ops, but
I mean, in regenerative agriculture, I'll be here talking about it all day too. I mean, I love ferments.
yeah. And in fact, when you think about co-ops and the potential for co-ops, I don't see why people engaged in a cooperative organization can't, in fact, make group ferments.
Totally. Yeah. That would actually – I mean, having one person or one committee or something like specializing in specific ferments because they can – you know, you have specific things growing on specific properties. You want to make your ferment from stinging nettle from the place that has a lot of stinging nettle. And the same thing with Equestria. So it's nice to have specific areas where you can harvest that, you know, almost all the time. And different properties will definitely have more access to that.
Do you know if poison oak can be fermented?
I have not tried.
No, I haven't either. But, you know, it's difficult. I have to take my tractor to deal with the poison oak because it's not shy.
No. I'd be a little worried about that one, just dealing with poison oak, the oils and poison oak. You know, there's a lot of things out there we can use that aren't going to get in your eyes.
I know. Or you end up planting your radishes and your hands come out all covered in poison oak. Okay. Well, let's forget that idea.
Maybe blackberries. Okay. Go for that.
We're coming up to the top of the hour, but we got one more caller. Let's get him in. Hi. You're in the studio.
Hi. How you doing? I just called you guys a minute ago.
Oh, okay. Great. You called back. Thanks.
I don't even remember why I called. No, it's about the fermentation thing.
Yeah.
You know what horsetail is?
Yeah.
There's a lot of, in southern Humboldt, I know, I used to go with a woman and she'd harvest horsetail out near Honeydew Road, up the Honeydew Road. There's a lot of it growing out there.
Yeah.
What you need when you're developing trichomes is silicon.
Mm-hmm. It helps with the cell wall integrity.
Silica.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's what drives the immune system, which is what develops the trichomes and the size and the number of them.
Totally.
Right? Are you there?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, in the grow room, I used to use this stuff called Growmore liquid calcium, which is in a base of horsetail extract, which makes it really high in silica.
Makes sense.
Right.
But if you want to make a mulch for pot, you need to put in some horsetail extract, or your potency won't be as great as you want it to be, because you're not getting as much silica from all the other things that you're putting in your mulch liquid stuff as you would be if you add a little horsetail.
Yep. I think it's a brilliant idea. I'm going to have to let you go. We got two callers.
Yo, it's all good. Don't worry.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for your call. Okay. You got to keep it short. We're right at the top of the hour.
Yeah, man, real quick. I'd say poison oak, get your neighbor with goats, and then use the manure.
Okay.
That's a good one.
And
okay.
The horsetail, definitely. We use that for our silica this year. That's the way to go.
Love it.
And the guy with the grass clippings, I'd say go for it, but try to diminish your lawn and grow vegetables. Have a great night, guys. Bye.
Hey, thanks for your call. Thanks. So we did make it to the top of the hour. This has been a fascinating discussion. I can see that we lit up our listeners, and they were calling
lively.
In with one good idea after another. Do you have any closing remarks?
Please check out Cooperative Agricultural Network online, and definitely check out the symposium at Cal Poly next spring. Google Cal Poly Cannabis Symposium. I'm sure that'll pop up with the website there. And if you want to check out Salmon Creek Legacy, Google that too. And keep an eye out for the next whatever HCGA's marketing committee box of special gifts is.
Okay.
Got a lot of things I do.
Well, thank you. So you have been listening to KMUG Community Radio's The Cannabis Show with your host, Steve Dodge, and later, Sunshine. She's in Jamaica. And we've been talking with Sean Cherry from Cooperative Agricultural Network. Next week, it's, you know, the 23rd is the day before Christmas. We're going to have a pre-recording with a couple of my own ranch hand friends of mine. And we're going to talk about the lay of the land. And if you didn't guess, that's a little play on words. Anyway, tune in. Listen in, and unfortunately, you won't be able to call in because it's pre-recorded. But we're hoping to make you a good show that you'll enjoy. And you have a great Christmas. It's always a great time of year. Okay, thank you very much. Good night, Sean.
Happy holidays.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you.
This has been a KMUG podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.